Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Maybe we could just jump right into it. Could you walk me through the sequence of events here? How did this happen?
What is the first part of the game, I believe? And always extra special when I get to play in Seattle in front of my family, get a little hyped up.
Johnny Hecker grew up in Bothell, but when he took the field in Seattle in 2015, it was against the Seahawks. At the time, he was a St. Louis Ram, L.A. Ram now. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and what Hecker did next made him infamous here in the Northwest.
It was just running down after I punted the ball, saw a body there, and decided to give him a little nudge. And, man, did not anticipate him going to the ground like that. Just caught him right at the right moment. You know, he's a big guy.
Personal foul, unnecessary roughness, number six.
And then as soon as he hit the ground, I thought, man, oh, no.
When did it dawn on you who you had just given a shove to?
Right after he got back up, yeah, I saw it was Cliff Averill.
We see him take a shot here, Cliff Averill. I don't know if you want to go around doing that to that guy.
I wasn't trying to be tough or anything. I was just, you know, giving a guy a nudge, like a little running down the field. And
let's unpack the dynamic a little bit for people who might be like a Fairweather fan.
Okay.
So you are a big guy, but punters are not sort of stereotypically giants.
Right.
But Cliff Averill is.
Right. Big man. So we're actually not too far off size. I might be a little bit taller, but he's definitely got me in some muscle poundage.
But he's also kind of a trained killer. Right?
Yes, I mean,
he's a pass rusher. He is he's out there to level people.
Yes.
And you're typically not having a lot of contact.
More of a finesse player, yeah. You know, it was a dumb play, and of course now I got four of the biggest guys on their team all mad at me trying to rip my head off, so I knew it was a kind of going like self preservation mode. It wasn't the most bright idea I've ever had in my life, I'll tell you that.
And how did the self preservation mode play out?
Michael Bennett is a charging bull, and I am a matador in a sense, just trying to not, you know, get gored out there in front of thousands. And,
so he takes a run at you on your next punt.
Yeah, he did, and I wasn't really having that. I punted the ball and shied away from contact, some would say.
He's going to avoid any kind of penalty. They saw what he did last time. Look, they want revenge.
I hate to needle you on it, but I describe physically how you evaded that maneuver. Like, what was your evasive maneuver?
There was a bit of going to the ground,
and
using
maybe
the hands and shoulder,
protecting your vital organs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I already have a helmet protecting my head, so just curling up, kind of protecting the rest of the body, and not leave myself open to attack. Yeah.
And how did Averill and some of his teammates react? And did that change, like, in the heat of the moment versus a little later?
Of course, the heat of the moment, they were all very, very upset. But, you know, as time went on, they realized, you know, it's part of the game. We'll just let him live. You know, I got a lot of flack on the internet and all over. So it was the kind of thing where I think they realized that I had done more damage to myself than they could probably do. So it's just crazy because that kind of stuff happens. Then you have little third graders calling you all sorts of cuss words on the internet and saying you're a wuss. And you're like, wow.
So when all said and done, do you regret doing it?
Do I regret doing it? That's a difficult question. There's yes and no. You know, that's how I play. I'm shouldn't really apologize for being an aggressive player and just building identity of being a tough guy, I guess.
Well, you're also a really good sport to come in and talk to us about it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. No hiding here. I'm excited. I'm in the area, so just to get to kind of clear my name a little bit. City of Seattle, please, you can love me now. Please.
Bothell native Johnny Hecker, now a punter for the LA Rams. I found him a total delight to talk to. I guess just because he seems so open and warm and self-deprecating. And you know what? Today, I don't need any more reason than that to share a story with you because, dang it, today is the Gabriel Show. This month, the Sound Effect team has been taking turns rounding up personal favorite stories that we've worked on. We've heard our show now through the ears of producers Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. And now, it's my turn. Okay, so I want you to listen to something. This is the sound when a balloon pops. Okay, so here is what it sounds like if a balloon were to pop inside of an empty 2-million-gallon water tank at Fort Worden State Park in Port Townsend. Now, that is what you call reverb. In fact, it's still going and going and will keep going for another 30 seconds or so. The guy behind that sound is named Stuart Dempster, and he is a pretty well-known composer and trombonist. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Washington these days, and he's had a long interest in recording music out in unusual places. So when he learned about this empty cistern, he thought, hey, maybe this could be a venue for one heck of an acoustic set, the ultimate unplugged album.
Composer David Mahler, who used to live in Seattle, he now lives in Pittsburgh, had told me about it, and he'd been in it. And when we went to do a workshop there together in 1978, they had decided, well, we can't have people in there. They had cemented it off. So I spent the next 12 years badgering Dan Harpel, for whom the cistern is named, to see if he could help in getting it open. And help he did. And eventually got permissions for people to do work in there. It's sort of like being in a wine cellar without any of the accoutrements. It was cold, damp, and if you set down anything for a little while, it picks up moisture, and you know, paper would become sort of not soggy exactly, but you knew there was a lot of moisture in there. All the walls were dripping. I figured that teenagers and other folks were probably partying in there and throwing beer bottles around and just to listen to the sound and the shattering glass. If you're going to build a chord in the cistern, which has a 45-second reverberation, which is quite amazing, you can build a chord up in any reverberation length by your first note being the loudest and longest and the second one being successively a little bit softer, a little bit shorter, and you can get several note chords. You play a note, and you can release it in such a way, if you do it just right, you can sort of play it and it crescendos a little bit, and then you diminuendo just slightly to leave the sound, but the cistern will continue crescendoing the note for a little bit. So you really can't tell when the cistern takes over. Old metal pieces that I can't imagine where a lot of that would have come from. We use the metal, and it's pretty fun hearing all that stuff reverberated.
What makes it artistically interesting for you and not just a kind of quirk or parlor trick?
You can set up all kinds of harmonies, of course, I think, but probably the main thing is that you feel like you have all this support. It's like a support of a really engaged audience. Something is supporting you, and of course it's your own sound. Sort of like drowning in whipped cream. It was rather a pleasant drowning. Drowning in sound is really something special.
Like it's almost being, you're almost flooded or overwhelmed, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's ambisonic to a degree that it's almost hard to fathom. I'd like to think of it as spherical because you're just getting sound from all over, and you sometimes lose track of what's you and what's the reverberation of you, and it's very, very special. It's really listening and deciding, well, this pitch will work really well here. You can't do a lot of stuff because then it turns into sonic granola pretty quickly. After about 3 days of practicing there, I came out and I realized that I had adjusted to the cistern as being the norm, and the rest of the world was seemed more alien than I was expecting.
So what has working in the cistern taught you about listening?
I suppose the most important thing it taught me and the most unusual thing is it taught me to listen to the end of the sound. Most people lose interest when there's still about 15 or 20 seconds of reverberation to listen to. Maybe it's only kind of a pulse that you feel maybe almost more than hear.
Where does the cistern work fall for you? What does it mean to you now, looking back on a long career?
If I had my druthers, I'd probably do nothing else.
Really?
Yeah, but yeah, it's just because it's such a... I'm somewhat into healing music as a restorative. I mean, there's many world cultures, there's no separation of art and life, or music and healing, as it were. It can breathe easier. It lowers my blood pressure, I guess. It's comforting. So anyway, I really like being in that restorative music space.
Stuart Dempster is a composer and an emeritus professor at the University of Washington. So, do me a favor, picture Sasquatch. For me, it's a very specific image. It's a big, hairy humanoid, mid-stride, arms swinging, head turned to glance back over its right shoulder. It's an iconic picture, and the thing that Bigfoot was turning back to look at was Bob Gimlin. Gimlin, along with Roger Patterson, gathered their famous film footage in Northern California in 1967. 50 years later, people still pore over it, debating its authenticity and speculating on how it might have been faked. Well, that film, which launched 1,000 Bigfoot hunters, also ruined Bob's life. Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. He's a man of many interests, it's just that most of them have to do with horses.
Say, oh, this is the old stud horse. He's an old-timer. Step on outside. Step out.
We are at a friend's farm in Yakima, where Bob keeps most of his horses. He's spent decades making his living around animals.
This old sleigh here, I'd hook Kilargo, that stallion, when he was young, to this sleigh and give the kids rides in here.
Bob is a real-deal cowboy. He used to break horses, he rode in an honest-to-God sheriff's posse, and of course, he rode in rodeos. When he was young, at least. He's 86 now.
I quit rodeoing altogether in 1958 and enjoyed rodeo, and that's where I met Roger Patterson at the rodeos.
Bob and Roger hit it off, but then after Bob quit the circuit, they didn't see each other for a few years, until one day in 1961.
I stopped at my uncle's service station down in Union Gap, and the guy walked out, and it was Roger.
As they caught up, Roger told Bob he wanted to show him something. He came back with a large plaster cast of a footprint, a big footprint. Well, Bob wasn't sure what to make of that, but he was open-minded enough that one day later, when Roger came knocking, he was willing to listen.
So he come running into my place, and he said, Bob, can you take me to Northern California? And I said, well, can't do it now. He said, Labor Day weekend, they found all these tracks down there after they come back to work.
Bob agreed to load up 3 horses in his trailer and head down to the area around Willow Creek in Northern California. The 2 men mounted up and headed deep into the woods on old logging roads.
The leaves were all changing, reds and yellows, and it was pretty rugged, you know, it was hills like that. We were just riding up there, and Roger was taking pictures of me on the horse and leading the pack horse. That's when Roger's horse started just the jumping and the lunging. And I could see that there's something going on there. I look over there and there's a Bigfoot standing just on the other side of the creek from us. But he just immediately turned, started walking away. Well, Roger by then had got his camera out of the saddlebag on his horse, and he was up running across the creek there. He hit the other side of the bank and stumbled and kind of fell down on his elbows. And that's when it made that famous head turn. It's when I stepped down off the horse. My mind thought, well, yeah, these things really do exist after all this I heard about them and stuff. And I've been wanting to see a track. Here's one walking right away from me, right in front of me here.
There was no doubt in Bob's mind. This was no hoax. This was Bigfoot. Once they'd calmed their horses down, they tried to follow her. She appeared to be a rather heavy-bosomed female, but to no avail.
And then we talked about the smell and different things and musky, skunky smell. And Roger said, oh, it smelled like an old dog that rolled in cow. And I said, well, yeah, maybe that.
Once the shaky footage was developed, Roger was giddy. He was sure he had a gold mine on his hands. But Bob was not so impressed.
When I first saw the film, I thought, oh, that ain't nothing. I said, I saw a lot more than that. So I was kind of the bad guy.
So that was the first crack in their friendship. They hit the road with the film, trying to interest investors and maybe sell the story to Hollywood. But Bob says his heart wasn't in it. He had horses to take care of.
You know, there was a lot of disagreement right from the get-go. I said, I got to go back to work to make a living.
Still, Roger and his associates continued the roadshow with one major difference.
They hired some guy that said he was me.
So, touring the country, making money with a Bob Gimlin impersonator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that was it for Bob and Roger. Bob says the two never spoke again. That is, until Roger was on his deathbed.
His brothers called me and said, Bob, he's asked to see you. So I went to see a little old dried-up guy there in a bed, and he rallied up a little bit and said, Bob, oh, man, it's so good to see you. And I said, yeah, Rog. Bob, he said, I apologize. And I said, well, why did you hire a guy and he saves me? Well, he said, we had to do something to get people to come in. And I said, well, dadgummit, Roger. He said, Bob, he said, I've got the money and the means and stuff now and the equipment. He said, as quick as I get well, you and I are going to go back down there to California and capture Bigfoot. Well, that was in the afternoon, and he was dead the next morning.
Bob says he forgave Roger at that point. But still, he seethed that this had turned into a payday for others, but not for him.
My wife said, let's just get away from it, Bob. You went through so much over that, and it's bothered you a lot and made a different person out of you.
What did she mean by that, that it's made a different person out of you?
Well, I was a person that never held grudges against anybody. Now, once you're thinking about hurting somebody.
And Bob chafed at the mockery, the constant mockery that seemed to follow him wherever he went. When the ridicule reached his wife at her bank job, that was the breaking point.
They razzed her about it in where she was working, and she'd come home bawling and saying, oh, God, Bob, I wish you'd have never went down there with Roger. And I said, I do too.
So Bob disowned Bigfoot. He stopped doing interviews and answering mail about it.
I used to get really upset, but kept saying, I keep my temper. Trying to just stay away from it for that 35 years until Dimitri said, I'm coming to the United States to have some time with you. Dmitry Baranov, a Russian scientist, one of the top Russian scientists, he said, well, if Bob can't make it to Russia, I'll come to the United States to have some time with him.
Bayanov has written about Sasquatch, as well as its counterpart, what they call the Russian snowman. He came to the U.S. to attend a conference in California, and he convinced Bob Gimlin to go along with him. Reluctantly, Bob agreed to give a talk.
And that's about all I can tell you about that short film footage of what happened.
He didn't know what to expect. For decades, his story had gotten nothing but ridicule.
It's still in my mind real clear, but when I see it, it's probably going to be a different story.
It was like lifting a weight off my shoulders. Here's all these people just anxious to hear what went on and believed in me. And when I walked in the room, standing ovation. And I thought, now wait a minute. How did this turn around in a few days?
Not only was he accepted by this group of believers, he was revered. He was a rock star. He started going to Bigfoot conferences again, giving interviews again, signing autographs. But not everyone in Bob's life was on board, which partially explains why he and I are talking inside of a Jeep parked at his friend's farm and not at his place.
My wife allows it, but she will not go to any of them with me because of the bad days that she had. She just says, I won't allow anybody that has anything to do with it to come to my place and do any filming or any interviews. You do what you want to, but I'm not going to go do any of it.
And that's sort of the agreement that Bob made with the world, too. He knows what he saw, and if you don't believe him, fine. You're the sucker.
I strongly believe if a real one walked in the house and sat down at a table, or the best it could, and they'd say, no, it's a fake, somebody in a suit. That's how naive they are. So that's just the way I'd tell them till the day they spank me in the face with dirt, you know.
Bob Gimlin lives in Yakima. Start at the Hebald Cultural Center near Marysville.
Yalta is my Indian name. Lois Landgrebe is my English name.
Lois is a Tulalip tribal member who, for 23 years, has taught a language called Lushootseed.
One of my favorite is the word for frog, and that is wuk wuk. The word for bird is ch'ich'alkub. And another one is eagle. It sounds like wings on air. Yahwala.
Lushootseed is endangered. Lois says maybe 55 people speak her dialect fluently. And as you can probably guess, it's not an easy language to just pick up. Especially when, like Lois, you were 25 years old and starting from scratch. That's because Lois did not start out on a path toward becoming a tribal culture bearer. Instead, her life has taken a series of unexpected turns, starting with when she was just minutes old.
I was relinquished at birth. My birth mother held me for 5 minutes, and she gave me up. I was in foster care for almost a year, and I was adopted by a white family, and they adopted both me and my brother. So we're not blood siblings, but we look at each other as we're practically like blood. My adopted mother, she had miscarriages and stillborn. So that's why they adopted. She had a miracle baby, and it was my sister. So just before she was born, the neighborhood kids informed us that they're going to give us back, that they're going to give us up because they now have their own child. And we didn't know that we were adopted. We did not figure anything out any differently. And it's really funny because my dad and mom would get pink and sunburned in the summer. And my brother and I would get dark brown. It never occurred to us. We just figured that's the way it was. So,
how old were you when those neighborhood kids were telling you that you were going to be given back?
6 years old, 6 and 7. So my brother and I decided we're going to be the best children ever. They can't give us back. So we devised a plan to just behave ourselves. And we messed up like children do. And we broke down and started crying. We sobbed uncontrollably for like 5 minutes. Don't give us away. We want to stay. They really had to sit with us and explain that, yes, we're sorry you found out this way, and that we went out and seeked you out. We picked, you know, we could have picked any children, any babies, any, but we saw you two, and that's who we wanted, and we're not giving you back.
So you learned at that time, though, that you were Native. You didn't know any more than that. What was your relationship like to your nativeness?
There was basically just the romance stereotype attachment. Basically, I loved getting my hair braided. And, of course, I had my dad make a strap deal where I could put a doll on my back. So I was really excited about that. And when we had Native Month, we made drums out of oatmeal containers, like Quaker oatmeal. When I was 11, my adopted mother passed away of stomach cancer. So that was just a trauma that we couldn't quite get over. My dad remarried 8 months later to my stepmother, and she was totally different. She didn't like us, which really traumatized my brother and I more. I ended up being a runaway, 13 to 16 years old. And my brother left after I turned 13. I ended up graduating high school, and my brother had found this organization called WARM, Washington Adoptees Right Movement Organization. And he got a case opened, and he wanted to seek out his birth mother. And he got the information, you know, they found her, and, you know, we were all excited for him, a little nervous too. And she turned him down. So, and she didn't want to meet him. So he kind of sat me down and said, look for your mom. And I was like just devastated for him. And it just broke me a little. And I said, I don't think I could handle being rejected. And so I decided not to. About that time, my boyfriend and I, we got married, and I had my first child. I was devastated a little bit because losing my mom came back when I became a mom. So I went through a little bit of depression. And after the birth of my son, a minister of the Lutheran Church I went to a few times came knocking at my door. And he said, Lois, you know, your family's looking for you. I said, what? I'm like sitting there going, they know where I'm at. And the minister, the pastor said, we got a call from your aunt and uncle. Were you adopted? And I literally had to grab a counter and sit down. And I said, yes, I am. So that's when I spoke to my mom on the phone for the first time. We were both just so excited to hear each other. But when it came to the actual physical meeting, it was just before Thanksgiving. She got there an evening early, and it was snowing. I mean, it was like there's already been about almost a foot of snow in Wenatchee. And I had to push our son's stroller through the snow to get to the motel because we didn't have a car. And got there to the door, and I absolutely could not knock. It was like almost like 10 degrees out. And my husband's looking at me, Jeff, and he goes, you know, are you going to knock? And I said, no, I can't. I'm about to meet her. And then he just, oh, for goodness, and he knocks. We're going to freeze. And she's inside with her husband, Arnie. And they heard the knock. And Arnie looks over at her and says, well, you going to get it? She froze and she goes, no, what if it's her? And Arnie goes, oh my goodness, we got to let him in. Went over and opened the door. I saw a short lady with dark hair and a face just like mine. And I stepped in and she saw me for a few seconds and she stepped back and lowered her head because she didn't know what I was going to do. I saw that gesture and I thought, oh, she's had it hard just like me. You know, and I just stepped forward and put my arms around her and she just melted into my shoulders and we both just cried. It was a void that I think I say that God or the Great Spirit had made just for, you know, our relationship to become what it became. I think I had to have that loss of one mom just to make room for Carol McKay Henry to step into my life and make it easier.
Lois Landgrebe is a teacher and storyteller. She currently works for the Sauk Suwattle tribe. Up next is some of the most fun I've ever had making radio. It's a little spin through history in the early days of Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo. Back then, all the monkeys were kept in cages until in 1940 they were relocated to a little human-made island surrounded by a shallow moat. The result was war, an all-out battle for dominance on Monkey Island that captured the city's attention that summer. Of course, a real war was brewing at that time, and perhaps as a little comic relief from the grim news out of Europe and Asia, the daily papers in Seattle breathlessly covered the Monkey War, tongues firmly in cheek. We present to you now a selection of excerpts, word for word, from the Seattle Times and PI's coverage of the war on Monkey Island.
Dictator commands fighting zoo monkeys, and all's well. Woodland Park monkeys that were moved from their cages Tuesday to their new Monkey Island have had a civil war and set up a government headed by a Chinese monkey named Sing. The monkeys that had been living in separate cages for years at the zoo huddled together in their original cage groups when they were first put on the Monkey Island. Then they started fighting. If a monkey got licked badly, the other monkeys threw him in the moat. We had to put the down and outers in cages again.
Monkey apes dictators, or is it vice versa? Rebellion looms. Ruled by a stir-crazy Chinese monkey named Sing, the 16 inhabitants of Woodland Park Zoological Gardens, New Monkey Island, were plotting revolution yesterday, much to the amusement of spectators, but to the great concern of the zoo superintendent, solemn Dr. Gus Knutson. Sing, assigned to command of the island kingdom after two other simian dictators had failed dismally to unite warring factions, turned in a good first-day performance, knocked half a dozen malcontents into the moat, and cowed the others into reasonable submission. Is the boss crazy? He undid it all yesterday, however, by continually biting his own tail and then screaming with pain, an act which cast grave doubts upon his sanity.
Sing Dynasty on Monkey Island ends. Dictator gets dunking. The high-branded and tyrannical rule of Sing, the Chinese dictator who governed with absolute power on the Woodland Park Monkey Island for the past 2 days, came to an abrupt and ignominious end in the presence of hundreds of excited spectators. 17 Filipino monkeys who had been Sing's abject subjects since Friday rose in rebellion, dethroned him without ceremony, and drove Sing into the moat.
Zoo monkeys depose flea-bitten dictator. The greatest sea battle of the War of Monkey Island was fought at sunset today, with the result that the mad monk of China, Tingling Sing, was badly defeated and exiled to that dismal St. Helena of Woodland Park, the Monkey House.
Sing!
truce declared in Monkey War. Outwardly, all was quiet on the Monkey Island battlefront here today, except for occasional fisticuffs between the Monkey factions. But dissension was glaringly apparent as the different rivals for leadership in the simian community made faces at each other and held councils of war from time to time.
Queen is planning to make monkeys out of dictators. The slap-happy inhabitants of Woodland Park's new Monkey Island were pretty cocky today after having performed to a Sabbath crowd that Zoo Director Gus Knudsen estimates at 25,000 persons. But they'd better not get too chesty in their newfound notoriety, for a female is plotting against them. She's no ordinary Monkeyland Machiavelli, though. She's none other than Cheetah, the African Queen.
Monkey Isle under suspicion. There is so much revolution and strife on Woodland Park's Monkey Island that Dr. Gus Knudsen, the zoo director, says he may have to appeal the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service to investigate the monkeys and weed out the undesirable aliens. I don't know how most of these monkeys got into the country, said Dr. Knudsen. They may have come in illegally. All I know is that people bring them here and say, how about taking this monkey? And so I take the monkey and ask no questions. Adam, the stool pigeon, fell under Dr. Knudsen's suspicion as a fifth columnist. Adam is a small monkey who spends all his time shadowing other monkeys, gossiping about politics and generally stirring up trouble.
In Zoo Hospital, Singh reposed today in the quiet of the Zoo Hospital, where he's nursing quite a few cuts and scratches received in the big naval battle when he was almost drowned. Never again will Singh be placed on the island, according to Knudsen. Knudsen believes a permanent ruler will emerge on the island within a few days. Meanwhile, none of the monks seem to trust each other, and Knudsen is keeping a watchful eye on the proceedings to be sure there are no casualties.
The monkey drama held spectators in thrall for much of that August in 1940. And then, according to the website HistoryLink, interest began to flag, and people turned their attention back to another conflict, what would soon become the Second World War. The Seattle band Culture Shock lives up to its name. They weave together Eastern European folk music with strains of metal and so-called gypsy punk. The new song Taiyu is sung all in Japanese. Culture Shock's songs promote justice and rail against fascism. Lead singer Gino Yevjevic is a burly, tattooed fellow with a shaved head, beard down to his chest and streaked with gray. Gino's passion for art, his compulsion to create, is what eventually pulled him out of the war zone his hometown of Sarajevo had become. In 1992, Yugoslavia was busy tearing itself to pieces. The country was breaking up along religious lines, leading to a long and bloody war. But before everything descended into chaos, Gino was living the dream. He was a clean-shaven, suit-and-tie-wearing, ponytail-sporting pop star. The name of his group, Gino Banana.
Gino Banana.
We became pretty recognized. I hate the word famous and celebrity, so I don't even know how to say that. Yeah, we were like, whatever.
Did you get recognized in the street?
Yeah.
Did you sign autographs?
Yeah.
Did people want to pose for pictures with you?
Yeah. No, there was no selfies, though. Selfies did not exist. It was great. And you know what? I have to say, like, people, oh, it's horrible burden. No, it wasn't. It was great. I loved it. Especially when you're a kid. It's amazing. And, you know, but then you overgrow it. Then you overgrow it. And then maybe something like war happens to, you know, to remind you, hey, you know. I don't know what would have happened. I mean, I probably would become one of those guys at the record label, you know.
If not for the war, you mean?
If not for the war, right. You know, I envy you actually. You guys go to war and you come back from the war. We don't go to war. War comes to us. Sitting home, minding your own business. Psh, boom.
For more than 2 months now, Sarajevo has been under siege.
Then we were trapped in the city. It's amazing. So we were in war, and you all of a sudden you can't get out, and you have a bunch of record-selling musicians in the town doing nothing.
So once the reality kind of set in of being locked down where you were, of the war being surrounding mm-hmm. Sarajevo, how did you cope? Like, where did you direct your energies?
I actually recommended my friends and these directors and choreographers and a bunch of actors. We were all in one theater, and I gave an idea to do musical Hair. I remember everybody saying, "Are you crazy, man? Anti-war musical in a war-torn country?" Like, yeah, but let's twist it out. Who cares? Let's play for ourselves. We did whole musical.
Was it one performance or a series of them?
It was about 300 performances.
Oh my gosh. So were you doing it like every day?
Every single day. At 1 o'clock p.m. because we had a curfew at 9.
And did people show up?
Packed every single time. We never had one place. And we ran it for 3 years. We got devastated. Our sound guy died like first year. My guitar player and co-writer, he got injured. By going to the theater, he's alive still. People took out of shrapnel out of his head. We redid the play again and running it until the point where we couldn't do it anymore.
Why was it worth risking your life to go make that show?
Selfish. Is allowed in art. Art might be one and only activity of a human that can allow selfishness as a positive category. That means that you're creating what comes to you, that the creation is a purpose to itself. That's, I think, what was driving us.
At the performances, UN officials and American celebrities sat shoulder to shoulder with the trapped residents of Sarajevo. The production also happened to catch the attention of Phil Alden Robinson, the man who wrote and directed the movie Field of Dreams. What had seemed like an insane idea just a few years before, putting on an anti-war musical in a war zone, ended up being Gino's ticket out of Sarajevo. Phil Alden Robinson got visas for Gino and some of the other cast members of Hair and brought them to the United States. He wanted to make a movie about this unlikely theater troupe.
Phil could not put the movie together because probably it wasn't very attractive to, I guess, it wasn't very attractive to Hollywood. There was no Steven Seagal saving Blonde from the barbarians, that don't know anything else but fighting each other. We were portrayed like a people, which, it's not sellable, I guess. And that kind of confirmed my stand about alternative music and alternative art, and never to go to the commercial world again. And then the only thing that we did, we came to Seattle and made the theater about the theater play. That was, the second prize.
And so you created the play Behind God's Back, yeah. Which was a play about the production of Hair. And what was that like to do? Was it?
It was great.
Was it weird?
It was weird. I constantly had a feeling of underperforming, not in the way of performance, but on the way of like I am. Very important for me was not to use my experience and that of many of my friends for my own gain. And in that moment, there were so many movies. Welcome to Sarajevo. Christmas in Sarajevo. What Christmas, man? You know, it's just like everybody's using Sarajevo left and right. And I didn't even want to use it in my songs. Didn't even want to use it in my theater play. If anybody should use it for the game, people of Sarajevo should use it for the game, not people over here, right? I felt it would be a betrayal of my friends.
When Behind God's Back wrapped up, Gino stayed in Seattle. He got a permanent green card, and he kept creating. In 1996, Gino formed Culture Shock. The band's still going strong with a devoted following in Europe. And then at some point, Gino found himself in a new kind of creative project as well. He writes plays, and he helps a specific population put on their own shows. People with developmental disabilities. Right now, they're working on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
It's time for me to do something for somebody else.
Do you get a different kind of gratification from that? Like, do you get a different satisfaction from that type of work than you did when you were center stage?
Yeah. I like supporting people in their achievements. I love it. I think that's what I was missing in my life. I'm finding it right now. Because it's beautiful when you see somebody achieve something, and you know that you support that. It's not about you. Art therapy and whatever, however we call it, is something that just crowned my life.
Gino Yevgevic, playwright, counselor to special needs adults, and lead singer of Culture Shock. To see a video of the band's new song, Tie You, head over to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. That's it for this edition of Sound Effect. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Ali Ferguson, Shane Mailing, and Arwin Nix. Max Wasserman is our intern, and our executive producer is Matt Martinez. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. We have a really special show coming up for you next week. KNKX will be opening our brand new building in Tacoma's Theater District, and we'll be hosting a live 2-hour version of Sound Effect, showcasing stories from the South Sound. The whole thing is open to the public, and you can learn more at knkx.org. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. You can find it all over the place, including NPR One, Spotify, or your smart speaker. And please also consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, or send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.